Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. I'm playing the music of Joan Baez because she is a singer of an era that I share with my first guest, Kevin Bell, the president of Lincoln Park Zoo. She also was the girlfriend of Bob Dylan, who won the last Nobel Prize in Literature, and I'm having some people on at 10 to talk about books. They're not having a Nobel Prize this year because they are caught up in the sexual harassment problem, something that has never, ever happened at Lincoln Park Zoo. Kevin Bell, how are you?
Hello, Rick.
You know, the funny thing is, we're just talking, and Lincoln Park Zoo is among my favorite places on the planet. It is dear to the hearts of every buddy who calls Chicago home, because I would hazard to say there is not a Chicagoan who has never visited Lincoln Park Zoo. It's almost, it's not a rite of passage. It's just always been there. Right, Kevin?
You know, I think it's, you know, it's conveniently located. It's easy for people to get to, and the fact that it's free.
Free.
You know, is, you know, it's welcomed families for, well, for 150 years.
Yeah, so. That's the thing. This is the 150th anniversary of Lincoln Park Zoo. And the stunning thing is, Kevin and I were laughing about 4 minutes ago, you've been there for almost a third of this.
I know, that's... I'd rather not think of it that way, Rick.
Yeah, I know. Kevin, you've been there for almost a third of it. We're going to talk about how the zoo has changed during your tenure. But what is it that you became at 23 years old... the youngest curator in the history of Lincoln Park Zoo. Let's go back even further. One of the great things about Kevin, and one of the great newspaper headlines ever written, to my mind, it was in a New York paper. It was the boy with 2,830 pets and a picture of you. What does that mean, Kevin Bell? How could someone have that many pets?
Well, you know, my dad, of course, was curator of birds at the Bronx Zoo for many, many years. And when he first was named curator in 1957, the Bronx Zoo actually provided housing for their curatorial staff. So we moved into the Bronx Zoo, right into the heart of the zoo. Our house was right behind the reptile house. And so I spent my time before school, after school, going around from building to building. And so, you know, they weren't really pets, but, you know, to me,
right.
I knew the
you
animals.
You didn't play with all of them. Yeah,
right.
But, I mean, I'm just wondering what kind of infusion of animal affection and understanding you got as a kid. Obviously, it has kind of dictated the rest of your life and career.
I think one of the things probably that affected me the most from my time at the Bronx Zoo, that was a, you know, the wild, which is now the Wildlife Conservation Society. The Bronx Zoo was one of the first zoos really that really got into research and into conservation. They had some of the forerunners of sort of modern zoodom in William Beebe and Lee Crandall and, of course, William Conway. And so I was surrounded by these people as I was growing up, and it really brought, when I came to Chicago, it you know, I brought with me that strong desire to sort of grow the conservation part of what we do. And, you know, the empathy for animals was always there. I mean,
sure,
I was always sort of enamored with birds because my dad was a bird curator, but I had the opportunity, living right in the middle of the zoo, to get to know so many different types of animals, many that were only kept at the Bronx Zoo at that point in time. So when I came to Chicago as bird curator, you know, I brought that, a lot of that tradition, that history, and that understanding about the need for conservation with me.
See, I think it's the understanding that has kind of guided your hand at Lincoln Park. And I think still, you know, I have the era when I remember it seems almost the way I would see animals in a zoo seems almost, in retrospect, cruel. You know what I mean? It was like, here's a lion in like a little studio apartment. Zoos have changed more radically, I think, than any kind of museum institution in my lifetime. The Art Institute, okay, they have a new building, but it's still art on walls. What's happened at Lincoln Park Zoo and other zoos around the country is not just important for the entertainment factor. It's a weird balance that goes on at zoos, I think, science and entertainment.
And fun, right.
And fun, yeah.
Well, you know, zoos really have changed. But, you know, for a good portion, if you look at the 150 years of Lincoln Park Zoo, for a good portion of that, we were kind of stuck in that menagerie kind of mode. And it really wasn't until, you know, the 1960s and 1970s that things really started to change. And that's really, it coincides at Lincoln Park with Dr. Fisher becoming director of the zoo, the forming of the Zoo Society in the late 1950s, which then led to the renovation of a lot of the old buildings at Lincoln Park.
Sure.
And as they renovated them, they started for the first time to really think about the behavior of animals and what you could do by creating an exhibit rather than just creating a cage.
Yeah.
So that both the animals' welfare is better, but also the people's understanding of the animals and where they live and the need to conserve them also goes along with that.
You know, we look back and think of zoos. I never saw Bushman. I was born, oddly, 9 months after he died in 1951. I may be the reincarnated Bushman. But there was a time when zoos were the only places someone could see a certain element of nature and, let's say, the wild kingdom. And that in its way was important too, wasn't it, Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the connection with animals, you know, was always there. Unfortunately, there wasn't the understanding of the, you know, the how we were destroying habitats of a lot of these animals and how the populations were decreasing over the time. So it really was more of that sort of fun experience. Oh, you know, you learn maybe the difference between some of the animals, but you don't really get an understanding of their behavior. You don't get an understanding of where the animals come from and what's happening to their habitat. So I think, you know, that's one of the great advances that's happened, you know, in the last half a century, really,
sure,
with the development of new exhibits, new techniques for educating the public, getting them involved with what we're doing at the zoo.
When you came there, these 43 years. I'm bad at
roughly
math.
Yeah.
I'm bad at math. The zoo was old. The look of the zoo, at least, was old, was it not?
Yeah, it was. But, you know, one of the reasons I think I stayed at Lincoln Park Zoo so long, I mentioned Dr. Fisher earlier. In 1976, when I arrived, at the very beginning of 1976, we were just starting to open some of the new buildings. So literally, I came in, and I remember I was, even though I was bird curator, I was working over at the Great Ape House, what became the Lester Fisher Great Ape
sure.
House, helping to hang rope for the animals and doing that. But they had just started the new sort of program of updating what was America's oldest zoo, or what we called America's oldest zoo. So, you know, things were really changing, and you know, Dr. Fisher and Barbara Carr, who headed the Zoo Society, just never stopped. You know, when they finished building something, it was, okay, what are we going to do next? What are we going to do next? So for those of us who worked there, it was a very exciting time.
No kidding.
To be involved with all this renovation.
And also a really creative time, too. I am spending this whole hour talking to Kevin Bell, the president of Lincoln Park Zoo, which is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year, this entire year. All sorts of events, a book. You can, if you don't know where Lincoln Park Zoo is, go to lpzoo.org and find out. I'd love it if someone's out there saying, holy cow, honey, we've lived here for 60. What is this zoo place they're talking about? Everybody in Chicago has been to Lincoln Park Zoo. We got to take a little commercial break, then I'll come back with Kevin, and we'll talk more about the changes at the zoo and all the really stunning things. There's a piece in today's Tribune by my colleague Steve Johnson, or maybe it was in Friday's Tribune. It's online at the Tribune, talking about a book that addresses some of the amazing things that Lincoln Park Zoo is doing. First, I'll tell you, if you like free White Sox tickets, you have to tune in to the Steve Cochran Show from 8:30 to 9 on Monday for your chance to win. Then, here's another Tribune-related thing. Fly to the front of the line at LitFest on June 9th and 10th with a Fest Pass. Get yours before they're gone at Printers Row at litfest.org/FestPass. Lincoln Park Zoo is free. I will emphasize that again. Lincoln Park Zoo is free. We'll be right back.
My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She doesn't have to say she's faithful, yet she's
Welcome back. That's Joan Baez singing songs written by her boyfriend. I remember taking, that TV star who I took around Lincoln Park Zoo that time. One of the great things, I've known and admired Kevin Bell, the president of Lincoln Park Zoo, since I first met him in the early 90s, just before he became the president in 1993. And her name was Veronica Hamill, and she came to Chicago. She was one of the stars of Hill Street Blues. She came to Chicago, and at the time, I wanted to take people out of hotel rooms. I said, "What would you like to do, Miss Hamill? I could take you anywhere in Chicago." She goes, "Well, I'd love to go to Lincoln Park Zoo." And I very excitedly called Kevin and said, "Guess who? You're going to have to give this woman a tour." And Kevin wasn't there. It's one of the great blown opportunities I've ever had. He is always there. You used to get to the zoo very early in the morning, didn't you, Kevin? And I don't know if those days still exist. And you would walk around, and that was a very special time for you, wasn't it?
Oh, it's a perfect time to be at the zoo. It's really quiet. The animals are just sort of getting up themselves. Yeah, when I was a curator, I think I probably came in at 5:30 in the morning. Now it's 6:30, quarter to seven, but it's still a great time to be at the zoo.
There are different demands. I remember, too, at one point when you came here right out of college to become the youngest curator in the history of Lincoln Park Zoo and to work for Lester Fisher, who is still around and who is still as – how old is Les?
I think Les is 97 now.
Get out of here. Yes. I saw him like 2 weeks. He's as lively as we are.
Oh, he's great, yeah.
He is as lively as we are. 96, yeah, and he looks – I don't know what 97-year-olds
look like. Well, he came into my office a couple of weeks ago to do an interview, actually, for our 150th.
Sure.
He's still sharp as a tack.
Wow.
Great guy.
Well, he must have been an inspiration to you all these years,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, Les was sort of a second father. If you know Les Fisher, he's one of the kindest, gentlest people you'll ever meet. Totally loves animals, but loves people, too. And he really... I think put Lincoln Park Zoo on the map. Before last,
Marlon Perkins, who was a showman of sort of great stature. He had to have a pretty substantial ego.
Yeah, he did. So he did Zoo Parade, of course,
sure,
in the 1950s, and then left Lincoln Park in 1962 when Les became director, and then he went down to the St. Louis Zoo. But I think, yeah, Marlon's was sort of bigger than life.
Yeah.
And Les was much different, but Les continued the TV shows with Ray Raynor, Ark in the Park, and Bozo Circus, and those kind of things, which were fun. And as curators at the zoo, we got to participate in those and help them set up the shows, so it was fun.
When you were the bird curator, for a while you were aware of the differences between being a curator and becoming president. There would be different demands on your time. And for a while, you were kind of reluctant to make that step, even though a lot of people wanted you to. Finally, you did. What about those demands? The demands are vastly, if you could talk about the demands, the differences between being the bird curator, which is a substantial job, and being the president of the zoo. I mean, it's fundraising. You are the public face of the zoo.
Yeah, you're right. I always thought I had the best job in the world. Same job as my dad, curator of birds. I was traveling all over the world. I was working with palominas in Indonesia and puffins in Iceland and, working with the Panamanian government and visiting Panama and working with bird species down there. So, it was a lot of great international travel and conservation work, not as much administrative work.
Sure, sure.
So when Les retired in 1992, they asked me to be the director at that point in time, and I said no. I just really liked what I was doing.
I remember that so well.
And they brought in someone else who only stayed for 10 or 11 months, I
14
think.
14 months. I 14
months.
Up. 14
looked it up.
Months. Yeah.
There's probably a technical part of that, too. I think it was a little less than that. But then they asked me again at the end of that point, and I thought, well, gosh, I think I could probably do this, and I don't want to live through another transition of somebody else who's not necessarily working out that well.
The biggest challenge during that time was privatizing the zoo. I think that's something that's an untold, basically untold story. Certainly the 4 million people who visit Lincoln Park Zoo don't realize those changes. Talk about that for a while, Kevin.
Sure.
I found that fascinating.
Well, and it was fascinating to me because I became director in June of 93, and in July of 93, I got the call from City Hall that they wanted to privatize the zoo. I was a bird curator. I didn't even know what privatized meant, to be honest with you. So there was a lot of learning that I needed to do, but basically...
Quickly, too.
Yeah, very quickly, and basically it was turning the management over from... We were part of the Chicago Park District. As director, I was a department head within the Chicago Park District. And they were turning over management to the Lincoln Park Zoological Society, which had been around since the late 50s. So it really, I think the education was learning what it costs to run the zoo and then figuring out a business plan to keep the zoo free.
Yeah,
and,
that was, I think, as I recall, that was your great priority, that there was a possibility that in order to privatize it, the Lincoln Park Zoo might have to start charging admission, and you were absolutely adamant that that would not happen.
Yeah, there were a lot of articles in the paper, I guess, rumors, people saying, well, the only way they can do this is to start charging admission. But, you know, our board of trustees at the zoo was adamant that we remain free. Mayor Daley certainly was adamant that the zoo remained free. So that never really became a big issue. It was just figuring out, okay, how do we make this work? Can we survive and not go broke, if you will, and keep the zoo moving forward? We were very fortunate when we did privatize, which happened January 1st of 1995.
Well, it was quick.
We were very, very fortunate that the economy was pretty strong at that point in time, and people were very generous to us. We were able to get off to a good enough start. And then once people kind of saw the changes at the zoo, so I think the biggest change...
What were some of those changes? Yeah, delineate them for me.
I think the look of the zoo changed almost immediately. So we took a lot of the grass areas that were being mowed by the park district, because they were easy maintenance, we turned them into gardens. So there was that physical change. Also, we really prided ourselves in keeping the zoo clean. And so when people, and the guest services part of things, which was not something that, that was a strength at that point in time of the zoo and the park district, but that became a priority for us. And it was sort of engaging with our visitors, making sure the guest experience was a good one. At the same time, we were continuing. We were actually in the middle of a campaign when we privatized, the Heart of the Zoo campaign.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So we were continuing to upgrade the facilities. And, again, we had, a very strong donor base. But back to your first point, people that come to, we have 3.7 million people that came to the zoo last year. Most of them don't really care. How the zoo is funded. They just know that it's free.
How much is popcorn? How much is this popcorn?
Yeah, they just know that it's free, and I think that's the important thing, and that's fine. I mean, that's certainly understandable. But it's been an interesting process, and one, I'm just I feel very fortunate to have such support from the Chicago community. It is really the community zoo. It's not our zoo. It's not the Lincoln Park Zoological Society Zoo. It's the people of Chicago.
It's the city zoo.
Yeah.
You have been to zoos around the globe, intimately involved in zoos around the globe. Is there anything that quite compares to this? As you can imagine, one of the great draws for me is this zoo is right in the middle of the city. And it is just, I know people who jog through there all the time and walk through there, and that's their way home from work. Is there any other zoo in the city that can give that sense of urban intimacy?
I think there are. I mean, Central Park Zoo in New York, for example, is located, in Manhattan and right off of Fifth Avenue.
Yeah, but it's not a free zoo. Exactly.
And it's very limited in terms of the animal species that they have there. We're a basic part of our zoo is 32 acres, and we develop a plan for keeping species that we know will do well in the type of habitats that we have at the zoo, the smaller space, and in the climate that we have in Chicago.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's worked pretty well. I would say I think the other one of the things I'm very, very proud of it at the zoo is not just the zoo facility itself, but Nature Boardwalk, which is just to the south.
Oh my God! Yeah,
which was something that I went to Mayor Daley with back in, I guess it was 2003, 2004, and sold him on the idea of taking this old Park District Lagoon and turning it into really a beautiful nature center in the city of Chicago. So when you talk about experiences in cities where you can visit zoos, there aren't that many cities that have a nature center sort of in the middle of the city.
Right.
So it's a great asset for Chicago's kids, school kids, to come and learn about nature, not just in the zoo, but you know, outside, in this natural area outside.
Yeah, one of the things, before we take a break for some news, one of the things that ever moved me when I was talking to Rich Daly about that, and he would talk to me about how he would go there after when Maggie was sick, when his wife was sick, and after she had died, that is a place that he found peace. And that has always just moved me tremendously.
Yeah, he was actually there a couple days after Maggie passed away. And he was by himself and just sort of absorbing the area. It was very moving.
That tells you a great deal about him, and it tells you a great deal about the city, and it tells you a great deal about that zoo. We'll take a break and continue on with Kevin all the way till 10.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think.
Hearing Joan Baez sing on After Hours with me, Rick Kogan, talking to Kevin Bell, the president of Lincoln Park Zoo. Do you still have those concerts at the zoo? What were those things called?
Oh, Jamming at the Zoo.
Yeah, Jamming at the Zoo.
No, we stopped those a couple years ago.
You should have stopped them because you would have, Kevin would go, hey, we're having this Jamming at the Zoo. Do you want to hear so-and-so? I'd go, I never heard of these bands. But, you know, the young people, Kevin, like that stuff.
Well, they did have some, I mean, Blondie was on one time.
Oh, yeah. One of the other things the zoo has always been noted for our special events. I have been to all manner of spooky zoos, which I think is one of the great mingling of the people of Chicago without class, without ethnicity, without religion. That is, it can be a little nuts because you've got hundreds, if not thousands, of kids in costume. But you have always done this kind of reaching out for special things for the whole city. Zoo Lights is like that.
Yeah, no, it's a very popular place. And you say hundreds or thousands. We have, I think, roughly 25,000 kids that come to trick or treat at Spooky Zoo, which is run by our auxiliary board. And you know, it's a great safe trick or treating for the kids. So they come from all over the city. But you know, we have three boards at the zoo. Our trustees do a great job raising money. Our auxiliary board runs things like Spooky Zoo. They do a gala that's coming up in another couple weeks. And then we have our women's board that does a great job raising money for new buildings that we're building at the zoo. And they do a gala that you've been to, Rick, in
the
summertime.
Yes, I have. Yes, once when it was very hot and then once when it was absolutely beautiful. Beautiful outside. Zoo Ball is what that's called. The whole Zoo Lights thing, the Zoo Lights thing to me is a phenomenon. I went to the I remember you, the first year you had it, you're saying, I don't know how this is going to turn out. You know, and who knows? You never know with things like that. It's a sensation.
Yeah, well, you know, when we started out, it was an after-hours paying event.
Right.
So you had to pay to get in.
I know.
And we were getting 50 or 60,000 people. It was a nice event, but then we realized that we could get sponsorship. And again, it was too confusing to sort of kick people out of the zoo and then say, well, now you have to pay.
Yeah, now you give us $10.
Yeah, so we turned it to a free event, and it's just skyrocketed since. So this past year, we had over 600,000 people in December come out for Zoo Lights. And, you know, we had rotten weather the second half
horrible.
Of December and into the first week of January. So we, you know, it was really that early part of December, late November, early December, where we had most of the people. We were getting like 50,000 people a night, which is actually more than we would like.
Yeah, sure.
Because the experience isn't as great when it's so packed.
Yeah.
And, of course, it ties up traffic around the area. So, we try and be less successful, I guess.
Yeah, right, I guess. You know, that's a bad way to be, Kevin Bell. One of the things that the average person who, and again, the zoo draws nearly 4 million people a year, which makes it, you know, Navy Pier claims to draw more, and Navy Pier is a vastly different place, and I don't know, except for, the Shakespeare Theater, I don't know what kind of cultural input or value you're getting from Navy Pier, no offense to Navy Pier. The average person coming to Lincoln Park Zoo, Kevin, how do they, I suppose going to the website would start to teach them about the conservation efforts. And I'm writing a a lengthy story for the Tribune in a couple weeks about a place called Chimp Haven, which you people are unbelievably involved. But you have scientists all over this planet doing work, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you look back, again, that privatization was kind of a key point because it allowed us to raise money for the more programmatic areas of the
right,
zoo.
Right, sure.
So our education programs, which now we call learning programs, our conservation science programs, as well as animal care and welfare. So conservation science, when, you know, early 1990s, we had 3 or 4 people at that point in time working conservation science. We have over 40 people now.
Wow.
Working. And we're really proud of the centers that we have that do work not only in epidemiology, endocrinology, but the Fisher Center. You mentioned Chimp Haven. The Fisher Center is really about the study and conservation of great apes. It does an incredible job both in Africa and Congo, as well as just here at Lincoln Park Zoo, learning more about the behavior and our partnership with Chimp Haven down in Shreveport. So that's a great center. We have, you know, the Urban Wildlife Institute has just taken off.
Which I think is a great – talk a little about that.
That really started with looking at the conflict between animals and people in public – in urban areas around the globe. So if you look at Chicago – and I know when I first drew up the idea of the Urban Wildlife Institute, I thought, well, okay, let's get into, you know, are there disease issues here? You know, I wanted to jump right into it. And fortunately, the scientists working at the zoo said, wait a second, we have to find out what's here first before we deal with how to better coexist with them. And so we set up camera traps all across the city.
Yeah, I know.
And, you know, we found that there were things, I didn't know there were flying squirrels in Chicago, but sure enough, you know, we found them. And so it developed into a process where we could really see how animals were using the city, how people could coexist better. And other cities now have picked up. I think we have 10 or 11 cities around the country that have signed on to the Urban Wildlife Information Network, which sort of tracks these animals in public spaces. And I think we'll be able to play a greater role in urban planning, in legislation to help protect the animals, but also enrich the lives of the people because, you know, they're coexisting with nature.
And, no question.
And quality of life is better.
No question. You also, to my mind, have – what's happened in your tenure at the zoo these 43 years, almost a third of the entire life of the zoo – is the whole world seems now, I'm not saying, you know, as we're faced with climate change and all sorts of other problems, zoos, to my mind, maybe aquariums do, I don't know, zoos seem at the forefront of trying to knit this entire planet together in healthier ways. I know that doesn't sound too scientific, but it's a little...
Well, I think, you know, we have a great opportunity just because the number of people that we interact with.
Yeah.
If you look at zoos all across the country, the accredited zoos, you know, there are almost 200 million visitors to zoos and aquariums, you know, to accredited zoos and aquariums across the country. So there's a great opportunity to get messages across there. You know, most people come to the zoo, they want to have fun.
Sure.
They want to bring their family.
Question.
But, you know, when they get there, we have programs that they can take that educate them more about animals, about their habitats, about their needs, about issues like climate change and what they can do to make maybe their lives a little bit, things that they do more sustainable.
You know, it's always occurred to me, one of my philosophies is that the easiest way to inform is to first entertain, because that opens people up. It makes them less afraid and less vulnerable to information. You agree? You must agree with that.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, if we were just hitting hard with a message and people weren't having fun, we wouldn't be having 3.7 million visitors a year.
Exactly.
But it's kind of a subtle way. You get them started at thinking about it. They have a great experience, then they want to learn more about the animals. One of the exciting things for me looking to the future is that by this time next year, hopefully we'll have Wi-Fi throughout the zoo. So when you come onto the zoo grounds, there'll be an app that you can get, which can even tell you more about the animals and more about the programs that we have, both at Lincoln Park Zoo as well as out.
Well, I know you have a lot of information boards there, but how cool to be able to point your camera at an animal and press a couple buttons and find out how many animals are they endangered, where do they live, what do they eat. Oh my God, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, no, I think it's, you know, it's obviously everybody that comes to the zoo now has a smartphone.
Yeah, no question,
you
have to take advantage of that, sure.
So it's a great way, and frankly, you know, from my standpoint, it also accomplishes something else, because we have a lot of people that come to the zoo that English is not their first language.
Exactly.
So when you have signage up and, you know, you have it in English, that's not necessarily going to impact people that
aren't fluent.
That aren't fluent in English. So by using technology, you can start doing things, apps and whatnot, in multi-languages.
This is an amazing thing. You just keep making the zoo better. My guest is Kevin Bell, the president of Lincoln Park Zoo. We got to take one more break. He will be at the City Club Monday the 12th to talk about the zoo and talk about basically the 150th. I'll give you a sneak preview of that after a couple short commercials. We will talk about this momentous anniversary coming up and the many things. There's going to be an exhibition that is opening on May 20th. There's going to be this book to which Kevin and everybody else at the zoo would like you to contribute, and we'll tell you how and why. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. I have just 10 minutes left with my friend Kevin Bell, the president of Lincoln Park Zoo, who's been terribly passionate and articulate, as he always is. This is, as I said, the 150th anniversary of the zoo. It started with two donated... that's true, right? It really was. I now think that story's apocryphal. I just think two swans like landed in a lagoon and we said, hey, let's start a zoo.
Well, you know, the funny story about that to me is, so, you know, we always said when I came to Lincoln Park, our tagline was we're the oldest zoo in the U.S.
Yeah.
Philadelphia said they were America's first zoo.
Right.
But, you know, we got these swans from Central Park. So kind of like, does it really matter? Thank gosh we don't have to talk about being old or first or anything like that.
Yeah,
we've got other things to talk about.
To my mind, it's the greatest zoo in the world. The zoo's putting together all sorts of things. There's going to be a special exhibition opening about 150 years of Lincoln Park Zoo with some astonishing pictures. There will be all sorts of events this year and a book that is in the making. And because, as Kevin said, this is your zoo. Ladies and gentlemen, it's not Kevin Bell Zoo. It's not Rick Kogan Zoo. It's not the Park District Zoo. It's not the city government zoo. It is your zoo. And toward that end, they would love to have, can't promise to print everything, but stories, poems, songs, photos, posters, write to the zoo. And you can write to a website, zoobook@lpzoo.org. Or mail stuff to Lincoln Park Zoo at 2001 North Clark Street, or write to me at the Tribune, rkogan@chicagotribune.com, and I'll pass it along. They want to know how you feel about the zoo, and it could be that you actually did fall in love with Bushman. You'd be very old now to have fallen in love with Bushman if you fell in love with Bushman, because he died in 1951. But that's the kind of stories they want in this book. You, of course, will have a I've seen a couple of the stories, Kevin, and they're so touching. You know, they're everything from, you know, we got married at the zoo to I'll never forget seeing my first animal at the zoo. Some of the older people, when you didn't have a phone, you couldn't call up and say, hey, what does a zebra look like, and get a picture on your phone. Those moments are really priceless. You, of course, are going to write something for this book.
You know, I think one of the things to me, I hear all the time, is the multi-generational thing.
Oh.
You know, the people now that are bringing their kids, they
and
actually
grandkids.
Were brought there by their grandparents back, you know, X number of years ago. So it's very generational memories.
What the zoo will, in the next generation, you'll set many of these things in motion, will sort of physically change again, won't it? You were talking about, you know, the accessibility of new technologies, but it's also the physical plant.
Yeah, we're finishing up the Pride of the Zoo campaign right now, which, you know, has some really wonderful exhibits that have already opened. We have the visitor center, the Searle Visitor Center, which is going to be opening up this fall. And then our biggest project in the campaign will be the Lion House, the Covelo Lion House, which is a historic landmark building, so it's creating some
Like the Tribune Tower.
Like the Tribune Tower. It's creating some real challenges for us to try and create new modern exhibits in a very old facility, but we're working on that. And
Will the outside of the Lion House change at all, the where the lions go out?
Yeah, I think the north, how technical I can be. The north side of the Lion House will continue to be lions, but it will be a much bigger habitat for them. More space for them to breed. Megan Ross, who's our executive VP, is working on that right now with staff to come up with the design. And hopefully we'll have that worked out by the end of the year, and then we just have to do some more fundraising. We'll get it started.
Well, and the thing about fundraising, and we talked about how Kevin, one of the things that made him a bit reluctant to take on the role of president, that you know, it's a joyful thing to fly around the world as the bird curator and not have the administrative chores. I have to assume one of the joys of fundraising, which I would be no good at whatsoever, you are feeling in a financial and giving way the emotions and feelings that people have about the zoo. That is, someone writes their name on a check, that to my mind is not like, I don't know what to do with my money. It's a emotional manifestation of love for the zoo.
Absolutely. I mean, and we're very fortunate. I mean, we have a lot of donors that aren't actually interested in the physical facility. They're interested in the programs.
Right.
You know, they want us to be out in the community. We have a great program now.
Chin Haven is another example of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of our great sort of welfare good feeling stories. But and we have we have a program in Little Village now that's very exciting. We're moving to North Lawndale, so out in the community, that's a big part of it. There are folks that give to the zoo just because it's a free zoo and they like that to continue. And so we're very happy and very fortunate to have people that give to a number of different parts of the zoo operation. You know, for me, I think fundraising is not difficult. If you have passion about what you're doing and you care about what you're doing and you talk to people about their passions and why they like the zoo, and it becomes, you know, not that difficult.
Well, you're getting your phone is ringing with sort of messages from California from a dear friend of both of ours, Danielle, who is now one of the world's biggest fans of the zoo. Is she not? Because she's gotten to know it through you on an unbelievably intimate level.
Well, she's a strong believer in conservation, and she's not only involved with me at the zoo, but you know she's a volunteer at the zoo. She does volunteer gardening at the zoo at Nature Boardwalk. So, and she loves doing that on Wednesday mornings. I think there's a large group that go out there and they do their weeding and planting, and so she's very much part of our staff.
Well, there's been a lengthy. I know a lot of people who have volunteered at the zoo over the years, and they get, you know, if they are not able to write huge checks for things, they give back in that way.
Absolutely. And you know, we have corporations in Chicago that they have a volunteer day where they bring their entire staff out to do projects at the zoo. So, you know, again, it's a community zoo. And so whether you're a corporation, you're an individual, the zoo has probably impacted you at some point in time, or you're your place of business. And so people like to give back.
Well, I also know that it's impacted your family, your sons, Joey and Charlie. Joey, named after your dad, who made you live at a zoo. They know that, obviously. Did they ever say, Dad, can't you build us a house? Maybe when they were much younger, because now they're maturing into sort of
teenagers,
young men.
Yeah.
They're teenagers. They don't want to live at the zoo. But they must have been so intrigued by that notion that they said, Dad, can we like live in the Lion House?
They still love coming to the zoo and walking around sort of behind the scenes. And both Joey and Charlie like feeding the rhinos and, you know, other things that they feel that's a special thing that they get to do. And I don't know whether either of them will get into the zoo field, but it's been a part of their lives.
Yeah, you would never pressure them to do that, just like your dad didn't pressure you to do that. You grew up at the zoo. Your dad would. He's been gone a long time, mm-hmm. I know. And your mom just relatively recently. Can you even tell me how proud your dad would be if he, I know it's impossible, Kevin, but if he could walk around Lincoln Park Zoo and say, hey, my son did this?
You know, I've actually thought about that a lot, Rick, because I, you know, my dad always thought that being a curator was the best job.
And yeah, I know.
Being director was, you know, kind of administrative. So, I always wondered how he would have felt about me, because he passed away before I became director of the zoo. But, you know, it's the same with you and your dad.
I know.
You know, it's we're following in our dad's footsteps, which is something very special.
I'll tell you one thing about Kevin Bell before I let him go. One of his father's bits of advice to him when he got the job, as when 23 years old, he became the curator here, he said, don't let anybody call you by your first name. Have them call you Mr. Bell. As long as I've known Kevin at Lincoln Park Zoo, I have never, ever heard anybody over the age of about 5 years old call him anything but Kevin. And that says something about the way you have run that place. LPZoo.org. For all the information. I do actually hope there's someone out there going, honey, this zoo sounds fantastic. We've lived here for 40 years. I wonder why we've never gone there. Kevin, it's an ongoing pleasure to know you, and it's a real ongoing great thing for the city of Chicago to have you run this place.
Thanks, Rick.
Kevin will be at the City Club a week from tomorrow talking about the zoo. All sorts of events. Go to lpzoo.org. Go to ZooBook at lpzoo.org to share your memories, pictures, poems. Write a song about the zoo. That's what I'd like to have. We'll be back after the news. As I said earlier in the show, welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. I'm playing Joan Baez singing Bob Dylan because Bob Dylan used to be her boyfriend, and Bob Dylan won last year's Nobel Prize in Literature, a understandably controversial choice. There is not one this year. Read why. But there are so many, and you know this if you listen to the show, so many writers in Chicago, and that is why it is my real pleasure to have Lynn Haller and John K. Wilson in here. They are organizing, among many things, the Evanston Literary Festival, something that kind of has slipped through the cracks of my chaotic life for the last 4 years. But I got to tell you two, and thank you for coming in. This sounds fantastic. How does it differ, let me ask you, from the Book Expo, which the two of you also orchestrate?
Well, the Chicago Book Expo that we organize in the fall is basically a one-day event. It's a big expo of all the Chicago area publishers, and as well as events with some Chicago authors. This is for us, it's a really frenetic thing to try and do an event that's really big in one day. And the Evanston Literary Festival, it's spread out across a week from May 12th to the 20th, so it is more of a neighborhood thing. It's more of a
series
local
of
thing.
series
of free events all around Evanston, taking place at the Evanston Public Library, Bookends and Beginnings Bookstore, Comics Revolution, as well as some other places at Northwestern, and it's really our effort to try and bring together and point a light on the literary community that's in Evanston as well as the rest of Chicago.
Well, I think the whole notion, and I may have read it somewhere, or the philosophy or your philosophical aim is buy local, read local. Is that, I mean, that's a Absolutely. Short summation of the whole thing. But it's too, as we have lost freestanding book sections, if we have lost all sorts of, you know, I can't remember the last time I saw a TV show devoted to an author who wasn't, Stephen King or somebody. To highlight, it's become even more important to highlight all the work that's being done here. Don't you think, Lynn?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it's so hard for authors these days to get the word out. So providing a platform for people to, for authors to connect with their readers, and for readers to get more invested because they get to know the authors and they, you know, sometimes when you see somebody in person, you get to meet them. It really bonds you to the
author. Oh, there's no, there is
no, nothing like that.
No question about it. That's why I'm so glad that some great independent bookstores still will do the, you know, the author readings or the author signings, and some libraries do that. Who are the two of you? Give me your background. I just met you, and I happen to be a great admirer based on what you're doing, but I don't know much about your background.
Well, my background is we're both independent freelance writers and editors. My background is more in higher education and academia and politics, and I've written several books, including one about Donald Trump that recently came out.
What's the title of that book?
That's called President Trump Unveiled, Exposing the Bigoted Billionaire.
Wow. When was that published?
It was originally published
anytime in the last 10 years, I suppose.
It was originally published in the fall of 2016, and then it was updated after the election. But I've been interested in this as an author who, of course, has difficulty, you know, finding a place to promote my work, talk about my work. It's something that I understand personally that a lot of authors are really looking for this opportunity.
Well, they need, I think they don't just desire this opportunity. I think you are fulfilling now what is an absolute need, because I think if someone, it's a wonderful thing. If you're independently wealthy, you can sit in your living room and write all the books you want and not care if they're published, but an author needs to have readers.
Right.
Lynn, what is your background?
My background is in publishing. I spent about 25 years in various forms of publishing, working my way up.
Locally?
Not locally. This was actually back in Cincinnati, where I'm from, before I relocated here. So I worked as an acquisitions editor, and I've worked as a literary agent, and now I'm a freelance writer.
Well, I don't want to make you out to be Lynn Haller and John K. Wilson as altruists here, but you being that intimately involved in the publishing industry, you have seen the chaos that has struck the publishing industry over the, I always say 10 years, but it's now probably 15 years.
Yeah.
It's dispiriting,
yes.
Is it not?
Yes. It is.
Well, at one level, it's dispiriting. On the other level, you're seeing a newfound resurgence of independent bookstores like Bookends and Beginnings. You're seeing authors finding new outlets to publish their work and promote their work that didn't exist before. So at the big corporate level, it's very dispiriting. But at the local level, it's actually quite empowering, I think.
So when you are putting together something as ambitious as this, I've got the list here, listen to it, ladies and gentlemen. How many separate events are there? I'm just going to plow through some. Children's story time. There's a family program. There's crime and poetry with a guy who's going to be on the show soon about a Matt Rizzo, distant father. It's called The Honey Accident. How many separate events? You don't have to be precise.
Well, we had 32 events over 9 days.
How do you two organize this thing? Is it you were connected to the Chicago literary community? There's no doubt about it. But beyond that, you were trying to put together a series of events that address all and that's eclectic on the face of it. Yes.
Yeah. I would say. With the Evanston Literary Festival, our secret weapon is the fact that we have other organizers working with us. Nina Barrett of Bookends and Beginnings, Jim Mortensen of Comics Revolution, Russ Johnson of the Evanston Public Library, and Rachel Webster of Northwestern University. So they're working on some of the events in coordination with us.
So
some of the other events were already going to happen anyhow.
So some
of it is us packaging this and adding enough events to make it really impact and to draw attention to what they're doing.
What did you learn from this? Is the fourth one. Fourth, and please go to, it's a very good website you've got too, Evanston Lit. Mm-hmm. LIT.org. It's a very good website. The festival takes place from May 12th through May 20th, which gives you, as potential book buyers and book lovers, a lot of flexibility in your schedule. I think that's a lovely thing, to jam all of this, as Printers Row Lit Fest, for instance, does, into one weekend. Makes it very, very, very difficult for the... I want to call it book buyer, but I'm going to call it consumer.
Yes.
In doing it this way, tell me what you learned. How was the first one, and what did you learn that has informed you since?
Well, I think the first one, we were sort of flying by the seat of our pants, doing it very quickly. And a lot of this, we centered around Northwestern University. They have a Spring Writers Festival where they bring in three different authors.
Right,
and so we use that as sort of the base, and we center the festival around them and then build the other events. And so a lot of it is about trying to build these relationships. Part of it is about knowing the Chicago literary community, what people have books coming out, and trying to find some people that we're particularly interested in trying to bring. This year we brought in some people even from the outside, who are outside of Chicago. Charles Johnson, National Book Award winner.
Yeah, no kidding.
Who was born and raised in Evanston. He's going to be one of our speakers on May 15th at the Evanston Public Library. And so we try and bring in... authors like Nadine Strausen, the former president of the ACLU, is going to be coming on May 20th to speak. So we try to bring in a few outside people, but we really want to focus this on the Chicago authors and Evanston authors.
That's what I find. And you know, any large-scale event like this, yes, it's great to, and you need to get a star in to, you know, and Johnson is undeniably a star. But that just helps bring more people in, to my mind. Right. And I think that's... And I think this aim to highlight local artists, because once again, they do not get, there's no light out there. There's no real light to shine on them. We have to take a little break, but I'm going to keep these nice people for another half hour. Lynn Haller and John K. Wilson are they're not the only people behind the Evanston Literary Festival, but they're the two most important people. That's me saying this. They're not saying that, so lay off them. I got to tell you, the Chicago Knows Best, right? Hit up Facebook and tell Chicago's Best TV where you like to eat. Watch Chicago's Best Sundays 10 on WGN TV. Your pick may be Chicago's Best. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Lynn Haller, John K. Wilson, and I tried to get Bob Dylan to come to the Evanston Literary Festival to talk about his writing, but Bob is an elusive character. They are in studio, John and Lynn are, to talk about the festival, which takes place from May 12th through the 20th. It's wonderfully eclectic and spread across those days in a fashion that will allow you to pick and choose what you want to see. EvanstonLit.org is the website, and it's a good website. I have to tell you, are you missing all the hot topics because you're spending all weekend outside? No worries, we've got you covered. Tune into the Steve Cochran Show Monday morning at 6 o'clock. When you put this thing together, and it has grown, obviously, the seat of the pants, as you said, John, that first year, what have you learned over the, when you were putting it together for this year, you obviously, both of you, have to trust your own instincts too, and some of the booking involves like what you would really, who you would really like to see in here, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of this was shaped by what, some of what we're interested in. We try and appeal to a broad audience of what, in terms of finding what people might like, but... Again, we're trying to do what the bookstore is interested in, what the Comics Revolution and the Evanston Public Library are interested in doing, as well as what we find around the community. And one of the ways this year we've tried to really kind of expand it and bring in more people is for the first time we're doing the Evanston Book Fair, which is going to be on Saturday, May 12th from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Evanston Public Library. And that's bringing in about 40 different authors, publishers, local literary organizations, some like Linda Gartz, who's been on this show.
Sure, she was on last 2 weeks ago.
Yes, yeah. And so they're going to be there. You'll be able to meet a lot of different authors, buy books from them, talk to them. And so we're trying to bring that element just to try and expand the reach of it, because one of the things we've learned is we're trying to scale down the number of events. We've had more in past years, and many times having conflicting events, it was much more difficult to manage.
I mean, that with all due respect to Printers Row Litfest, that is one of the troubles of Printers Row Litfest, where you have to choose between, you know, your favorite author and your second favorite and your second favorite author. Lynn, talk to me. You mentioned earlier about what it means for how important it is for readers to meet and connect with. You know, it's not like you're going to go out drinking all night, but they're in, like, as we used to in the old days. But there is something really wonderful about that. There's almost an immediate intimacy, especially if it's an author you have already read. Don't you think? Could you talk to me about that for a second?
Absolutely. I think having that personal connection, sometimes just hearing, I think one of the things that's really interesting with some of these events is the amount of information you get about their craft. And that's something that the Northwestern Spring Writers Festival is brilliant at. Every year they bring in three different authors, a nonfiction author, a fiction author, and a poet. And in one of their sort of keystone events, and that's part of our festival, is a conversation with all three of them. And it's just a fascinating
input
of their methods, how they work.
Yeah.
And one thing I will say is that you can go to, and you'd have to Google Northwestern Spring Writers Festival. They have an archive of the last 10 years, and it's fascinating. I mean, you have phenomenal people that they've brought in year to year. I mean, just, you know, Roxane Gay, George Saunders. I mean, just all these great people. And the interplay between, you know, I don't know, a poet and particularly because it's cross genre, it's so interesting to see the similarities in how, say, a poet and a nonfiction writer might work.
And it also, don't you think, it demystifies the entire craft and art of writing, because many of us are taught that writers are somehow a rarefied breed because their words are between the covers of books.
Right.
You know, if you were ever to go to hear a poet, I'm trying to think, Billy Collins, for instance, former poet laureate, he's the most accessible guy in the world who you would like to take out to a bar and drink with. But you will find that, and I think that makes their work more accessible too. Am I being too naive about this?
No. And I think one of the things that's interesting about this is that a lot of people who attend these events are you know, writers themselves. And so it's inspirational to them to see this is just a person like me, you know? They might be brilliant on paper, but they're a person, you know?
No, that's a really good point. Jen, you feel that way too?
I think so. I mean, I feel as a writer, I don't have that mystical connection to books, I guess, that some people do. I don't see it as impressive.
No, you will meet pretentious authors. There's no question. Yeah. We're not trying to tell you that.
And many of them are the really talented ones.
Yeah.
I think that have that kind of spirit. And it really is amazing going to a lot of these different events, how impressive the intellect of these people are, and you see a piece of it in their books, but really talking to them, hearing them speak, you get a sense of the kind of depth of understanding that's required to put together the kind of books that they write.
Yeah, I think you mentioned George Saunders. When you hear George speak or talk, you kind of can't help but fall in love with him. I mean, yeah, but he is indeed smart, but it's kind of a accessible intelligence, I think.
Right.
Now, what do you two do? You can't, you are both writers. Are you still an agent? Boy, that must have been Are there any agents left in this world?
There are, but it's a tough racket.
Yeah, it is a tough racket.
You're doing a lot of work that you don't guarantee to make any sales from.
Yeah, but I also think that you two, over the last, I'm going to spend the last 10 minutes with these nice people, Lynn Haller and John K. Wilson, after the news, talking about very specific programs that you should not miss. Now we're talking more generally. I've got to believe that over the last few years, with Book Expo for about 7 years and now the fourth year of the Evanston Literary Festival, you have come to understand the depth of talent in this area and have to have been and continue to be impressed by it.
Oh, yeah. I think there's just so many really incredible authors who a lot of people may not know about. One of them speaking at our event, Daniel Borzetsky, on May 16th, talking the National Book Award winning poet, talking yeah. about his new book of poetry, Lake Michigan, about that's about Chicago. And
right.
and there's an enormous really depth of the kind of talent around Chicago, and they're not the people, you know, who are celebrities in either book culture or in Chicago culture. And really, that to me is one of the key things. And there are shows like yours that are trying to make and events like ours that are trying to give some attention to these people that are in many ways more famous outside of Chicago than they are within it.
That's really, really, really well put. Who comes to the Evanston? I know that's such a stupid question. But can you generalize a little? I mean, yes, it's people who love books. I have to think there are others who, you know, who just want the experience, that it's not all Book Expo must have a lot of would-be authors, but it's people who are drawn. I got to think some people are just those kinds of people who are drawn to an event. Make any sense?
Yeah, I think we try and reach out to a diverse audience. I mean, of course, there is a stereotype of Evanston of the, you know, the older progressive liberal type and who's retired and that. And we get a lot of people like that. But we really try and reach out to a diverse audience. And Evanston is a diverse area compared to a lot of the national.
Well, that's another thing. Yeah. I think that people who don't know Evanston don't know how diverse Evanston is.
Right.
That's another thing. Evanston's a delightful suburb. There's no question. Its downtown has now gotten too big for me, but that's another, that's something for a psychiatrist, couch. You've got Pam Banos, who I know pretty well. There's an interesting program with her, Vivian Meyer, A Photographer's Life and Afterlife with Pam Banos, which is on Sunday, May 13th at the Evanston Public Library. Do you know her? Have you met Pam?
Yeah. She spoke at the Chicago Book Expo. We've seen her speak. She was at the Evanston History Center recently, and she's a fascinating speaker.
Oh, she's terrific. And Vivian Meyer.
She's doing something specific for Mother's Day. She's planning the program specifically for Mother's Day, and I believe her mother will be there.
Oh, I thought she was going to bring in all of the kids that Vivian Meyer took care of as a nanny. I'm going to keep these two people. I'm going to have them pick out each of them pick out three not to be missed events during the Evanston Literary Festival after the news. So please stay tuned. I'm with John K. Wilson and Lynn Haller. Go to evanstonlit.org and listen to the news.
We carried you in our arms on Independence Day, and now you throw us all aside, and put us on our way. Oh, what dear daughter, 'neath the sun could.
That's Joan Baez, the former girlfriend of the Nobel Prize winning Bob Dylan. I have for a few more minutes Lynn Haller and John K. Wilson, two people who I've grown to admire tremendously for a lot of reasons. But not only do they help put on Book Expo, they put on this Evanston Literary Festival, which takes place May 12th to the 20th. evanstonlit.org is a fine website. I want each of you, in the time we have, to induce the listening public to go to three events during that. And they're not telling you what to do. They're suggesting. The website has all sorts of information. Lynn, what do you think?
I have to say I'm really excited about the book fair that we're having the first day. I think that's
a great idea.
And I will say you could buy a great present for Mother's Day signed by an author. This is if you're not caught up yet.
Very
your
smart.
Mom likes books.
Very smart.
So yeah, that's a good way to support and a good way to support writers and put money directly in their hands. So
yeah.
Very important. It's hard to look at it. It's like choosing.
Yeah, it's like choosing
yeah.
your favorite child or favorite meal.
I'm really looking forward to the.
What about this? What is? Do not submit Evanston.
Evanston.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, that's
too.
Actually a.
And it's in a bar.
Yes,
always it is appealing in a bar. For authors.
And it's on Mother's Day in a bar, so it might
nothing
be
wrong
something,
with that. Depends about
might be something.
Depends what kind
actually,
of relationship you have with your
interactive,
mom.
This is a really good. Do Not Submit is a really interesting storytelling series that happens within neighborhoods all over Chicago, and this is the Evanston version. Anyone can come and tell a story for 7 minutes.
You get 7 minutes.
So this is not a totally passive literary festival.
Yeah.
You can actually be up there. And
you can, you can but yeah. The other thing is you can also go in there, grab a drink, and just sit
yes.
and listen, too. So it can be.
Yeah, it is one of the few events that that does have alcohol. So that's a
John, do you have any suggestions for the listeners?
Well, I might suggest some of the political stuff that appeals to me the most. One is on Saturday, May 12th at 6 p.m. It's the Writers Resist at Bookends Beginnings.
Yeah.
And we had done this before last year.
Right.
At Bookends of Beginnings, when it was a Chicago-wide event of various authors and activists, and we'll have about a dozen different people reading from their work, reading about politics, reading about activism, and really trying to inspire people to get involved in that. And some of the other political...
More important than ever, yeah.
And another political event that I'm going to be a part of on Thursday, May 17th, is actually focused on a book by another Evanston author, David Ferris, who's a Roosevelt University professor and who has written a book called It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. And so that's an event with the Northwestern College Democrats that
you'll
be
love
working
there.
With.
So you also have a number of stuff for kids, too, which I think is, I was reading somewhere or in talking about, the increased at one point people rang the death knell for independent bookstores, and that never happened. And a recent story I've read or heard is there are more now than there were 5 years ago. Yes, big chains have gone out of business, but the independent bookstore is resurrected, kind of. And that also that children really like books. Children who have my daughter's 13 and is about as technological as Steve Jobs was, wants a book. She doesn't want to read on a gizmo or a machine. And I am so heartened by that. Have you had your experience too?
Yeah, I think that a lot of kids see these books as anachronistic things because they spend their whole lives on the computer, and the book is a break from that that life. It's something strange and alien to them appeals.
But it's also, I think, like a piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think because children's books are so artful that you two seem you wouldn't be doing this if you weren't hopeful, would you?
I think we're hopeful. I think that for all the turmoil in the book industry and people regularly proclaiming the death of the book, I think it is that it is a powerful thing that links people together. And what we're trying to do with the Evanston Literary Festival is really try to create those social connections that people maybe didn't realize are there in books and in literature and trying to strengthen those connections that people have between authors and readers, but also between the whole community themselves as a literary community.
There's something about that gathering of human beings, whether it's in a library or a bookstore or a bar, mm-hmm. that is increasingly important in this sort of technologically increasingly icy age that we live in. You guys are fighting the good fight. It is such a pleasure to finally meet the two of you. Lynn Haller and John K. Wilson, they're the one of the, they will tell you, one of the two of the forces behind Chicago Book Expo, and two of the people who are putting on this Evanston Literary Festival from May 12th to May 20th. Go to evanstonlit.org. And Roger Badish, the newsman, is out there. He's in the midst of writing his memoir. He's going to grab you when you walk out the hallway and say, book me for next year. This will, maybe it'll make you finish this thing. How many words have you got now? How many words so far? Too many, he says. That's like every author. Like Thomas Wolfe. Yeah, Tommy, you need Maxwell Perkins to be your editor. You too, it's really a pleasure to meet you, and good luck with this thing. I'll remind people next Sunday on the air, too, that it's going on, and keep me posted about all you're doing. John, Lynn, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. My great pleasure. We got to take a little commercial break, and then you will hear Studs Terkel interview the very, very, very young Bob Dylan in 1963. Studs Terkel is dead, as you may know. He died on Halloween in 2008. But this is a real... The Studs Terkel archives, 5,600-some interviews of his, is going to be made available to the public on Studs' birthday, which is May 16th. And this will be a preview of one of them. So stay tuned.
Seems like only yesterday I left my mind behind. Down in the gypsy cafe.
That, for the last time, is Joan Baez singing Bob Dylan. On May 16th, which would have been the birthday of Studs Terkel, his incredible archive of more than 5,000 interviews is going to go live at studsterkel.org. Here is Studs. This is one of the 5,000 some hours. Here is Studs interviewing the 23-year-old Bob Dylan.
He looks like Huckleberry Finn, yet he lives in the 20th century. His name is Bob Dylan, and certainly one of the most exciting of singers of folk songs around today. Bob writes most of his own material. Certainly he's an original, and this is one of his. We'll talk with Bob, and perhaps even musically walk with Bob in a moment, after you hear more about his own true love.
It's down and round the old Mexican plains. They say that the people are all friendly there.
describe you, Bob Dylan. Rumpled trousers, curly hair. You know, Bob Shelton of the New York Times speaks of your writing, some of the music, the songs that you sing, is they can't be pigeonholed. The minute you have one characterized, it flies away. His lyrics mix a silo sermon out of Guthrie's, Woody Guthrie's conversational folk say, with a dash of Rambo's demonic imagery, even a bit of Yevtushenko's social criticism. Whether his verses free or rhymed, whether the mood is somber, crusading, satiric, subject or fanciful, Mr. Dylan's words and melodies sparkle with the light of an inspired poet. And I think Bob Shelton has something after having heard you sing a number of songs and a couple of your albums. Bob, where are you from? Beginning. Where did you come from?
Well, the beginning, you know, was there in Minnesota. But that was the beginning before the beginning. The beginning was not till about 3-4 years ago. 5 years ago, really. Or maybe it was even before that.
How did that happen, the 5 years ago? Perhaps we can explore before that, too, a bit later. How did that 5 years ago happen, and you come to songs, or these kind of songs?
I don't know how I come to songs, you know, but doing what I'm doing. I'm doing, I mean, I start. It's not up to me, you know. I don't really go into myself that deep, and
you just go ahead and do it.
I just go ahead and do it. Yeah, I'm just sort of trying to find a place to pound my nails, you know.
Well, and pounding your nails when you were. Did you hear songs when you were little? How did this come about? Did you hear records of Woody Guthrie?
Well, I heard Woody.
Because Woody, I know, is a factor in your life.
Oh yeah, Woody. Woody's a big factor, Woody. I feel awful lucky, but, you know, I feel lucky just to know Woody.
Now, you did something. You were in the Midwest, and one day you took off and you went to the hospital in New Jersey to visit Woody. Why'd you do that?
Well, I didn't take off for the hospital there. I was around the country before that, and I'd heard of Woody. I knew Woody. I saw Woody once a long, long time ago in Burbank, California. Which was, I was just a little boy. I don't even remember seeing him, you know. And I heard him play.
That's interesting. You say when you were a very little boy.
Yeah, it was about, I think it must have been about 10.
Who took you here? Your parents took you there?
My uncle.
Your uncle took you there, and you were very small.
Yeah.
And that was a memory. You remember, though,
yeah,
don't you?
Yeah, I remembered Woody at that time, yeah.
What was it stuck in your mind?
That, it stuck in my mind that he was Woody. And everybody else I could see around me was just everybody else.
Uh-huh.
But he was Woody.
You mean there was no one else but one?
Yeah.
And that was he. And I think, if I may venture an opinion, there's no one else but one to hear in you, Bob. And though you've influenced... Well, perhaps this will come along as we're talking and singing, too. I'm asking now about you. And it's hard to separate you from the songs you write and sing. You write most of your songs, don't you?
Yeah, I write them all now.
Well, what makes you write a song? Let's say there's one that I know Pete Seeger sings and Will Holt sings your song. It's a, and the only way I can describe it is a great tapestry. This hard rain's going to fall. Well, before you tackle that, what made you write that?
Well, I'll tell you how I come to write that.
All right.
That's just one of them kind of songs. It's just one of those I wrote like that. I wrote that because, you know, every line in that really is another song, you know. It could be used as a whole song, every single line. And I wrote that when I didn't know how many other songs I could write, you see. That was during, I think, October of last year. And I remember sitting up all night and with a bunch of people someplace, and I wanted to get the most down that I knew about into one song as I possibly could, so I wrote that.
It was October of that night. What, that was during a crisis?
Yeah, that was during that blockade, I guess is the word.
It was during Cuba, and you worried. So you put it in song.
I was a little worried. I can't say I was.
You were elated.
I was a little worried. Maybe that's the word.
So you wrote the song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, could you sing the song?
You got it on the disc there. I'd appreciate it if you could do it that way.
Which would you prefer, the disc or you're doing it?
If you take it off the disc, I could sing the song, but it takes a long time to sing. And if you'd like me to sing it,
I would. Well, if it isn't.
I don't want me to, I guess.
I would like you to sing it. I'll tell you why after you sing it. Yeah?
All right. Sing
it. Because I think this is some song we could talk about. I don't mean so much the content itself as the form, the lyrics, the images. And you call this Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. And I know people will be listening to it as you sing it. And, let come with me.
Son, and where have you been, my darling young one? I stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's hard, it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard.
Pretty amazing, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? That's a 23-year-old Bob Dylan. And the best part, and the whole hour interview is fantastic, and Dylan plays a few more songs, but the great thing is about it is how Studs Terkel browbeats him, makes him get his guitar out. He's like, Bob, like, well, it sound better on the disc, and Studs like, well, I'd like to see you play. It's fascinating, and that is just, you've heard 10 minutes of more than 5,600 hours of the Studs Terkel archive that's going to go live for your enjoyment on May 16th. Thank you so much for listening today. Visit Lincoln Park Zoo, will you please? It's a Chicago jewel. Thanks to Ben Anderson for producing, Aubrey Mumpower for extraordinary engineering, you for listening, Roger Battish for delivering the news.